We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right.
I'm not going anywhere today.
Neither am I. I look out at my deck and I see over 8 inches of snow accumulated out there.
Yeah,
and more coming down.
We've got about a foot here so far.
Yeah. Pretty crazy. The Puget Sound area is known for getting snow at least once or twice a winter, but usually it's maybe an inch or two, and then it melts later in the day and is gone right away. We don't usually have accumulations like this.
Not usually.
Not usually.
not every year, but we do.
Every once in a while. I mean, we can get several inches, but not typically, you know, close to a foot and continuing to snow like this. And then I guess today it's going to possibly go above freezing and then tonight freeze harder again and bring more snow. So that's a disaster really in the making for Seattle, because that's going to make the streets impossible. We're a city of hills, so, and not rolling, not gentle rolling hills, but really steep hills. So that makes driving practically impossible.
Yeah, and if you think you have a four-wheel drive and you can get up that hill, don't try.
Yeah, the answer is no. No, it's a complete sheet of ice underneath your wheels, and four-wheel drive does not help. Neither do chains when it's really cold.
I have a history of living on steep hills and, you know, watching vehicles get three quarters of the way up the hill and then pinball backwards all the way back down.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not a good look.
No, and your neighbors are going to appreciate you not smashing into their car and not destroying the neighborhood trying to drive anywhere. So the next couple of days, I think we're all here at home, not just because of COVID-19, but also because of the weather.
Yeah, but at least we have lots of practice on staying at home.
Yeah, what I found kind of interesting is that we're not the only ones in the nation who are snowed in. There are places getting snow this year that don't typically see snow at all, and it really speaks to the disruption of the jet streams because of climate change.
Yeah, the East Coast has already had two major storms that went farther south with snow
than normal.
They usually do. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a disruption of the jet streams. And that's to be expected and is in all of the predicted climate models for climate change.
Yeah, including here in this area, Puget Sound area.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So let's get to local news.
After following our weather report.
Yes. We'll be doing sports later in the show.
Yeah, no.
All right. So local, we have an election coming up later this year. Multiple people running in different
In the final race
categories
that no one had declared yet, Pete Holmes said this week that he's going to run for his fourth term, re-election to his fourth term as a city attorney for Seattle. He won his first race back in 2009, approximately 12 years ago. He has supported and helped implement things like the LEAD program, which diverts low-level offenders from jail into drug treatment and other assistance programs to get them off the street and into stable housing and jobs. And of course, this has brought him into conflict with conservative members of the business community who view things like the LEAD program as soft on crime. And they blame a lot of the problems from our last two most recent economic downturns, including the housing crisis, which threw a whole lot of people out onto the street. They view programs like the LEAD program as the cause for homelessness and things like that, rather than these economic downturns that we've had and viewing them as and viewing, you know, our underclass as a side effect of our economic system, which it really is. And of course, because it's brought him into conflict with the business community, the last time he ran, Scott Lindsay ran against him with a lot of support from the business community. And in spite of a lot of spending to try to get Scott Lindsay elected as city attorney, Pete Holmes proved to be super popular. He beat Lindsay 3-1.
Lindsay basically ran on a platform of get rid of the icky people, and it didn't really work very well.
No, it didn't.
So we'll see if the business community tries to mount a serious challenge against Holmes again. I suspect they will. And we'll see who they cough up.
We'll see. Yeah, so far he's the only candidate in the race. No one else has declared yet, but we still have until May. So we may see another very conservative attorney throw his hat in the ring. He or she may throw their hat in the ring and declare that they're running for city attorney. We'll see.
All right. Also this week, we were seeing some changes with the participatory budget process.
Oh, yeah. And this is kind of sad. City Council last year issued a contract with King County Equity Now to research the needs of the Black community and communities of color in Seattle in preparation for allocating millions of dollars in the city budget for funding community-based health and safety projects, which are meant to divert people from ending up on the streets or cycling through the criminal justice system. This was the major goal. So the sort of the other side, the flip side of the coin of defund the police was to adequately fund underserved communities, particularly communities of color. Now, King County Equity Now contracted with the Freedom Project of Washington to be their fiscal sponsor and to handle the financial side of that $3 million contract with the City Council. Then King County Equity Now, which originally formed as a coalition of community groups sort of centered around Africatown, they decided, okay, we'll start hiring some folks to do research work on what the needs are for the Black community and communities of color. And those researchers came together and called themselves the Black Brilliance Research Project. And this week, a large number of those researchers in the Black Brilliance Research Project, including two of its leading founders, broke away from King County Equity Now and announced that they would finish the research project by working directly with the Freedom Project and the City Council, cutting out the middleman, so to speak. Their reasons for doing that include a suspicion that King County Equity Now, which went from being that informal coalition of groups to a formal nonprofit organization back in October, is becoming too establishment. Sean Glaze, the research director who helped to found the BBRP, wrote and published a letter in the Seattle Medium calling out the leadership of King County Equity Now for a number of offenses, which seemed to indicate a power struggle between the leaders of the BBRP and King County Equity Now leadership. But I think it hinges on a couple of things. One is the researchers in the Black Brilliance Research Project appear to be younger, more radical. There's a significant LGBTQ component. And they seemed to, when folks started to look at the first report that they made to the City Council, there seemed to be a pretty high representation of youth versus elders in the Black community. King County Equity Now said earlier this week that they wanted to bring in and expand representation among the researchers to include Black elders, Black education, Black entrepreneurship, and more. So that's kind of what they told the Seattle Emerald. And to me, that says, okay, you know, the original group, the Black Brilliance Research Project, are these young, more radical folks who pushed really hard and lobbied the City Council really hard to get this money and to get this project going. And once King County Equity Now became a formal nonprofit, then older folks stepped in black business owners wanted to get in on it. And of course, there's a big pot of money at the end of this rainbow, right? Once the research project is done, you know, that project is going to be determining who gets funding from the city council, and there are millions at stake here. So that drew in a whole lot of other people who had been sitting on the sidelines when these younger folks were lobbying the city council really hard for this project to go forward. So unfortunately, it looks like your typical, you know, movement where the young and the radical start, push hard, win some gains, and then more establishment folks with more resources step in and want a piece of the pie. And I think that's really unfortunate. And I think what remains to be seen is if the city council is going to allow the Black Brilliance Research Project to cut out King County Equity Now and to work directly with the council through the Freedom Project, or whether they're going to accept King County Equity Now's proposal to cut out the majority of the Black Brilliance researchers.
I would say, unfortunately, this is fairly predictable. We saw this schism going all the way back to the George Floyd protests last summer, where you know, the CHOP / CHAZ protest that was driven largely by younger, more radical youth, was really poo-pooed behind the scenes by the sort of older establishment African-American community. And this is a carryover from that. It's fairly predictable, unfortunately. It's kind of a setup.
Yeah. And whenever you throw millions of dollars of funding into the mix and potential funding into the mix, it just exacerbates these differences. Right now, Tammy Morales, who is the city council member that represents District 2, which covers most of South and Southeast Seattle, she's been listening to both sides, trying to find some common ground between them. We'll see if she can bring the two groups together, or if there's going to be an irrevocable split. We'll just see. But definitely this argument is going to delay the process. The research project was supposed to be completed by the end of this month so that the city council in March could then start talking about how to allocate that money. We'll see if that continues on time or if there's going to be a delay because of this. So that was unfortunate news to hear this week.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of unfortunate news.
Oh, yeah. The City Council Public Safety Committee this week met to put the finishing touches on the amendment of the City Council's crowd control weapons ban. Last year, in the midst of the George Floyd protests here in the city of Seattle, the City Council passed a ban, an outright ban, on the use of crowd control weapons on demonstrations by the Seattle Police Department. That ban then went that ban didn't go through any kind of a review process by the court appointed monitor for the Seattle Police Department or the Department of Justice. And so Judge James Robart stepped in and he put an injunction on and halted the ban, saying, nope, any changes you make like that have to go through the court-appointed monitor until you guys are in the clear and no longer under the consent decree. So the City Council Public Safety Committee has been working on changes, right? The committee's chaired by Lisa Herbold. They finished a revised draft of that ordinance, and instead of sending their revised bill to the full council, the committee, after voting on the amendment then voted to send the draft to the court-appointed monitor this time and the U.S. Department of Justice to review it against the consent decree. And this time around, instead of issuing the total ban, what they did was the committee took into account the recommendations of the three oversight bodies, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department, and the Community Police Commission, and made changes based on those recommendations. In addition, Lisa Herbold looked at the ruling made by Judge Richard Jones last summer when he issued an injunction against the use of less lethal weapons on demonstrators by the Seattle Police Department. So the following changes were made. The words crowd control weapons were replaced with the words less lethal weapons. Because those weapons can be used for more than just crowd control. It adds a prohibition against outside police agencies using less lethal weapons when they help the Seattle Police Department with crowd control, and that had been missing from the original bill. It bans the use of 40-millimeter launchers to deploy chemical irritants of any kind, specifically for crowd control in a demonstration or rally, but it doesn't ban them for other uses. So, for example, in a hostage situation, it requires that 40-millimeter launchers can only be used by SWAT officers recently trained in their use, and they can't use them for crowd control in demonstrations or rallies. It allows the use of pepper spray for crowd control in violent public disturbances and says it can only be used if there's imminent risk of serious injury that would outweigh the risk to bystanders. So pepper spray can no longer be used to just protect property. That's pretty key. And it has a provision with similar wording for tear gas. It is allowed for crowd control in violent disturbances, but it can only be used, one, by officers who've recently been trained in its use, two, only if a detailed tactical plan was developed prior to its being used, and three, it's necessary to prevent threat of imminent loss of life or serious bodily injury, so it can't be used to only protect property. The bill gives individuals the right to sue the city if less lethal weapons are used against them in a gathering that's not a violent public disturbance. And then finally, it defines what a violent public disturbance is as quote, any gathering where 12 or more persons who are present together, use or threaten to use unlawful violence towards another person or groups of people, and the conduct of them taken together is such as would cause a person of reasonable firmness present at the scene to fear for his personal safety. This differs a bit from state law, which allows a riot to be defined as a gathering of three or more people. So there's some difference there. Now, the revised bill passed the committee by 4-1, with Lisa Herbold, Lorena Gonzalez, Tammy Morales, and Andrew Lewis voting for it, and Shama Sawant voting against it. Sawant wanted it to be a stronger ban, like the original bill that she had introduced in the city council last year that the city council passed. Now, the bill now goes to Antonio Oftili, the court-appointed monitor, and the Department of Justice for a 45-day review. If they have problems with it, then there's going to be a 2-week period where they will discuss potential changes with the city council. If the two sides can't agree, then the bill goes to Judge James Robart to review and to rule on it. Robart, of course, threw out the original ban last summer. In the meantime, the Seattle Police Department is making minor changes to its use of force policies, and it's expected to submit those changes to the Department of Justice and Antonio Oftili very soon, too. So we'll see what the court monitor and the Department of Justice do with these two conflicting policies, because they're not going to be the same. So that's where we are with the city council's amendments to their ban on.
And what kind of sanctions are there if the Seattle Police Department decides to just do what they want anyway?
Well, the sanction is that individuals can sue the city. Those are the sanctions. So essentially, it's giving individuals the right codified within the city law to be able to just turn around and say, "Hey, I was in a peaceful demonstration. You used pepper spray on me just because it was convenient and you wanted to clear the street. I'm suing."
I'm still having a hard time understanding how that impacts the Seattle Police Department itself. You know, what's there to prevent them from just, you know, doing what they want because they don't like the protesters?
Well, you have to look at structurally what's going on with the Seattle Police Department in the city, right? Now, our current mayor says she has no control over the police department. So, of course,
that's been evident.
this threat of lawsuits against the city by individuals whose rights are violated in demonstrations is meant to put pressure on her to exercise her oversight function, which she has not been doing, right?
Yeah, and there are already a number of lawsuits pending from last summer, as well as all the
But those lawsuits are under current city law, right?
Yes.
Where the ban has been suspended by the judge. So if this law passes and the judge and the court-appointed monitor in the Department of Justice and the judge signs off on it and it does become law and it's not suspended, then it provides the right for people to sue. The lawsuits will proceed rather than being stalled in court as they are right now. And many of the lawsuits that are in court right now are meant to just try to prove that the Seattle Police Department is abusing their authority by using crowd control weapons in a way that is outrageous. And what we're finding is that it relies on the three oversight bodies, particularly the Office of Police Accountability's ability to get the video that they need from the Seattle Police Department and the evidence that they need from the Seattle Police Department. And that's been extremely difficult. So that's an issue as well. And that's partially governed by the disciplinary process, right? And partially governed by the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract and what can be turned over and what, you know, subpoena powers these bodies have, also governed by state law. And I'm going to talk a little bit later this morning about what changes the state legislature is looking at making to police disciplinary process here in the state of Washington.
Yeah, I there are some good things in this. I think in particular defining what constitutes a violent, protest, because of course, the Seattle Police Department last summer was very quick to declare everything a riot at an unlawful assembly when, you know, it was by and large a peaceful demonstration.
Yeah, and they used the pandemic, I think, a lot as an excuse to do that.
Yeah, so that part is good, but as always, accountability is the issue, and the union contract, which is now being negotiated, presumably by the city, that will be key.
Oh, it will. And whether or not the mayor is intent on finalizing that contract before she leaves, I don't know that she is. And
well,
if she does,
she certainly doesn't want a police chief. So.
Yeah, and if she does, then the question will be, did she work hard to get to win really good a really good disciplinary process? Or
yeah,
did she give in to the SPD negotiators, SPOG negotiators?
And we know in the last go round with an attempted contract which was rejected by the courts for undermining the reform process and setting the city back, she didn't try very hard.
No.
So she really doesn't have any incentive to do that now.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Yep.
In court news this week, Tim Eyman lost his case in court. This week, Thurston County Superior Court Judge James Dixon ruled that Tim Eyman committed, quote, numerous and egregious, end quote, violations of campaign finance laws in Washington State, and he will be barred from quote, managing, controlling, negotiating, or directing financial transactions, end quote, of any political committee in the future.
This is where we need Mike to kick in with a you know, a sound effect of, you know, massive crowd cheering. So it's long overdue. This should have happened a couple of decades ago. But,
oh, yeah.
It really does, you know, shut down his money laundering scheme, where he's been profiting personally off of his initiatives for years and years and years. And, you know, really this is the first meaningful sanction that prevents him from doing that in the future. He also lost another lawsuit yesterday, where he and Clint Didier and some other reactionary Republicans were suing the state to try to overturn Governor Inslee's mask mandate and other pandemic restrictions, claiming that he didn't have the authority to do it. It was all unconstitutional, et cetera. That got thrown out yesterday, too.
Yeah, so that's...
It was not a good week in the courts for Tim Iman.
Yeah, no, it kind of makes you wonder how he has the resources to pursue that other lawsuit if he's actually going through bankruptcy, as he claims. Judge Dixon fined Iman $2.6 million. Iman was charged with pocketing campaign contributions, accepting kickbacks from campaign contractors, moving money between different initiative campaigns, and concealing the source of political contributions, all major violations of the state's campaign laws. Dixon ruled that Iman was 2,975 days late in filing monthly campaign finance reports that are required under state law. So for those of you without a calculator at your side, that's over 8 years late. What I found most disturbing about some of the details of the case are that Iman could have done it all legally. I mean, it was really simple for him to just take a salary or a consulting fee from his campaigns. He could have just done it all really legally, but he didn't. You know, he laundered and hid the money that he pocketed, possibly, and I think this is interesting, to avoid paying federal income taxes. And federal tax fraud is a really serious crime. It's not just a fine there. You can go to prison for that. But I think this just seems totally in line with a man who writes initiatives that attempt to prevent the state of Washington and local jurisdictions from levying any taxes at all. And as I said, Iman has declared bankruptcy, saying that he can't pay any of his fines. And Attorney General Bob Ferguson has said that he doubts the truth of that. But if the IRS has been auditing Iman because of all this and has levied heavy fines on him, it is quite possible that Iman lacks the cash to pay his state fines. We know that his biggest donors have largely abandoned him, and it doesn't look like he's going to be able to solicit new ones in the future because of the state prohibition.
Most of his major donors have died in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're you know, old wealthy people who didn't want to pay taxes, and they've passed.
Yeah.
So he's been scrambling for new donors in the last couple of years.
Yeah. So that was interesting news.
So, state legislature, still very busy.
Yeah, I wanted to just kind of take a look back at some of the police accountability bills that I talked about back in January that were just being introduced in the state legislature and do an update on where they are right now, about a month later. So I'm just going to kind of run through the list really quickly. Senate Bill 5055, that would standardize disciplinary processes across the state for all police departments, including allowing the state to keep a list of 9 arbitrators to be assigned in alphabetical order to hear disciplinary cases. And it would ban any local laws or union contracts that would change or modify the system. It would also prohibit any collective bargaining agreements that would overturn any city or county law that sets up a civilian review board or process. That bill passed the Labor, Commerce, and Tribal Affairs Committee in the Senate and the Rules Committee, and is now headed for a vote on the Senate floor. So it could pass the Senate in the coming week or two and be headed for the House.
Can you please repeat what bill that was?
That's Senate Bill 5055.
Okay, thank you.
So keep an eye on that one. Senate Bill 5134, that's the broader police accountability bill that included a bucketful of prohibitions. That's been stuck in the Senate Labor, Commerce, and Tribal Affairs Committee where it was introduced for the past month, and I think it's unlikely to go any further. The narrower bill, 5055, is the one that's moving this year. House Bill 1054 bans the use of chokeholds and neck restraints by police officers in the state of Washington. It also bans the use of tear gas and military equipment, the use of unleashed police dogs to apprehend suspects, and forbids police from covering their names and serial numbers on their badges. This bill is struggling to get out of committee in the House, but it may still make it to the House floor. So that one's kind of slowly wending its way through.
Isn't next week the legislative cutoff for getting bills out of committee?
Yeah. So, it's going to have to move a little bit faster early next week in order to make it by the cutoff. House Bill 1089 would allow the state auditor to review investigations of deadly force by police to determine if the investigators are complying with state rules. It would also allow the state auditor to review the training and certification of police officers by law enforcement agencies in the state. This bill passed the House on Wednesday and is now on its way to the Senate. So that one looks like it's moving along swiftly and is going to make it into law this year, as long as it moves through the Senate. That's House Bill 1089. House Bill 1267 would establish a state office of independent investigations to hear cases of deadly use of force, in custody deaths, and cases of sexual assault by police. This bill passed the House Committee on Public Safety on February 4th and is now in the Appropriations Committee because it's going to require the state to spend money to set up an Office of Independent Investigations. Any bill that involves the state spending money in order to enact it has to go through the Appropriations Committee, where the legislators sit down and try to figure out, okay, where do we have money in the budget to pay for this? So once it makes it through the Appropriations Committee, if it makes it through the Appropriations Committee, then it will head to the House floor. Through the House Rules Committee and to the House floor. That one may make it through. We'll see. House Bill 1203 would require localities within Washington State with at least 15 police officers to establish community oversight boards by January 1st, 2025 to investigate and hear complaints of police misconduct, including issuing subpoenas to gather evidence and testimony. Kirsten Harris Talley is one of the leading co-sponsors of this bill, House Bill 1203. It is also in the House Appropriations Committee because it contains a requirement for the Washington Association of Police and Sheriffs to follow up and report to the legislature on which localities have complied or not complied with the law. So again, there's going to be a need to allocate and spend money on it. So that bill's moving along, but we'll see if it makes it by the cutoff. That's House Bill 1203. In the Senate, Senate Bill 5051 would establish a state licensing board for police in Washington State and would decertify officers who are fired for misconduct so they can't get a job in another police department in another city or county.
At least in Washington State.
Yeah. This passed the Senate Committee on Law and Justice on January 21st, but has been languishing in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. That's the equivalent of the House Appropriations Committee. Ways and Means would have to find money in order to set up the licensing board. But it was finally put on the calendar for a vote on February 15th, so it could still make it out of committee to the Senate floor in time for the cutoff. That's Senate Bill 5051.
And that's coming up on Monday, so make your voices heard.
Yeah. And then there are a couple of progressive tax bills that have been introduced in the House Finance Committee. I just wanted to very quickly talk about them. These bills have been newly introduced, and we'll see if they can make it through the process quickly. Some of the fiscal bills are just now being introduced because they are not subject to the cutoff because they're budgetary bills. they can take a little longer to make it through the process. I just want to mention these two. House Bill 1465 would change the estate tax law in Washington state to exempt more smaller estates and would raise the rates on estates worth over $3 million. This was introduced on Tuesday, then February 9th, by Democrat Tina Orwall of the 33rd Legislative District in South King County, which covers Burien, SeaTac, Kent, Tukwila, et cetera. And then there's House Bill 1496, which would impose a capital gains tax. Governor Inslee talked about a capital gains tax before the legislative session this year, and this is the House bill that would do that. It would exempt the first $200,000 of gains of capital gains for individuals, and the first $400,000 of capital gains by couples would not be subject to the tax. It has a longer list of exemptions too, including retirement savings accounts, gains on the sale of your primary residence if it's under $5 million, sales of livestock, agricultural land, timber and timberland, among other exemptions. This was introduced on Thursday, just a couple days ago, by Tana Sen, who represents the 41st Legislative District, which is Mercer Island, Bellevue, Renton, and Issaquah. Governor Inslee, as I said, called for a capital gains tax, and there are many localities around the state that have been talking about a capital gains tax, including the city of Seattle, but the Seattle City Council's been waiting to see what the state legislature might do, and this is that bill that we want to keep an eye on. It's House Bill 1496. So, if you want to track any of these bills in the state legislature this year, you can always look up the bills by bill number or search for bills by subject matter on the Washington State Legislature's website. And what is that address? leg.wa.gov.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Click on bill information on the left to look up bills by their bill number or subject matter. On the main page, you'll see a list of committees meeting today. And if you click on a committee, it'll take you to that committee's page, and you can sign up to testify there or watch the committee hearing online, which all of them are being done virtually now. You have to sign up to testify at least an hour before the start of a committee hearing. So, that website address again, leg.wa.gov.
Okay. I'm sure it'll be burned into everybody's memory now.
Yes, leg.wa.gov.
Okay, we got it.
So, this week, Governor Inslee appears to be opening up the majority of the rest of the state for business, I guess.
Last week, regions 1 and 2, which were basically West Central, the area around Olympia and Grays Harbor, and then the rest of Puget Sound, which is, Pierce, King, and Snohomish, were moved from phase 1 to phase 2. Effective tomorrow night, Sunday night, we will see most of the rest of the state, with the exception of South Central, that is basically Ellensburg, Yakima, and Tri-Cities, is still in phase 1, but everything else will move to phase 2. So you can have indoor dining, you can have small groups meeting in private residences, the various aspects that are going to phase 2. Now, the concern about this, the metrics that the state is relying on to move all these counties to phase 2 are basically that new cases have been and hospitalizations have been flat and slowly declining since about the middle of January. That part is good. But we also know that the more contagious British variant is well established in Washington state. We saw again this week that more counties reported such cases, particularly Clark County in Southwest Washington. And we've had all three of the counties in the immediate metro area for Seattle having recorded such cases at this point. So I'm not sure that this is a particularly wise move on the governor's part. It seems to be driven more by economic concerns than public health concerns. And I don't think it's time to relax, honestly. If you've been self-isolating because you're at risk, you should probably keep doing that. You should definitely keep doing social distancing and wearing masks in public areas, et cetera. And of course, for the next couple of days, not many people are going to be going out anyway. But, yeah, this is going forward also. It's going to take a while to get the pandemic under control in Washington State. We saw a very positive development yesterday. The 1 millionth person in Washington State was vaccinated, a 90-year-old woman in East Wenatchee. So that's about one out of every six adults in Washington State has been vaccinated already in the last 2 months. And,
that's just the first shot, only about.
Yeah, I was about to get to that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
A fair number of those people, but certainly nowhere near a majority, have received a second shot as well. It's about, I believe, about 100,000. Received the second shot.
About a little over 3% of our population has been fully vaccinated, and that's, I think, way too low.
Yeah, it's way too low. And remember also that once you get that second vaccination shot, it still takes a couple of weeks to become fully effective. So,
well, and you're not completely, it doesn't completely prevent you from getting COVID-19. And I think that's something people don't understand. You're not completely immune to COVID-19, then you could still get it and spread it.
Yeah,
so wearing masks, washing hands, social distancing is still going to be required.
The clinical trials showed both for Moderna and Pfizer, which are the two vaccines that have been available so far, about 95% of efficacy, which means about 5% of the population that is fully vaccinated is still not particularly protected. And I would add to that, we don't have good data yet on whether vaccination prevents people from spreading the virus. Mm-hmm. You may not get any symptoms, but it can still be in your system and it potentially still could be spread. We don't know that yet. So wear masks to protect other people and to protect yourself.
All right.
So that's the local update. National update. We saw progress this week from the Biden administration in obtaining enough vaccine to vaccinate every American. They purchased another 200 million doses, 100 million each from Pfizer and Moderna. That will give the federal government enough of a stockpile to send to the states and the counties and the health providers and all the rest of it to vaccinate every American, probably by about the end of summer. So, that's the goal right now. And,
that's one dose per adult. So not the full vaccination.
Yeah.
It requires two doses.
Yes. It requires two doses for the vaccines that are currently available. Mm-hmm. We've also got at least three other vaccines that are in the pipeline for approval, probably in the next month. We have Johnson & Johnson. We have the AstraZeneca. And I'm forgetting there was one other.
Yeah.
Novavax.
AstraZeneca vaccine, though, has been found to be not effective against the South Africa variant. So there's some question there as to whether or not that one is gonna maybe move forward. And then there's some issues with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine too, maybe not being as effective as the first two.
And that brings me to the variants and the news on that, which is that the British variant in particular is spreading very rapidly across the United States, particularly California, Florida, Georgia, Eastern Seaboard. And as I said earlier, we've had some reports of it in Washington State also. It seems that almost all of the people who have been identified with the British variant as a positive test do not have travel histories, so they've gotten it through community spread, which is a very, very bad sign. It means in all likelihood, given that the genetic sequencing required to identify it is not something that's happening in a lot of the country, it's likely to be much more widely spread than we understand so far. If vaccines are not effective against variants, and several of the vaccine makers are working on vaccines that will cover the variants, but that's always going to be a game of catch up, because as soon as they come out with a vaccine, it's very similar to flu shots. where if you have a vaccine that's effective against one variant, it's not going to be effective against the next variant that comes up necessarily. And we're going to continue to see these variants. We apparently have a number of different variants that have taken hold in California now that are more contagious.
Yeah.
So that's very much a concern, and it's going to be a cat and mouse game between the vaccine makers and the variants, probably going forward. This is something we're going to have to live with.
I think what we're going to be seeing in the future is we're going to be seeing, you know, you get your flu shot every fall and you get your COVID, you know, your COVID quad shot where you've got four variants of the COVID, you know.
The open question with that is how often you'll have to do that, because we don't know at this point how long the vaccines confer effective antibodies against the virus. We just don't know yet because we haven't had time to find out. But it could be more often than once a year. It could be that you get it three times a year. We have no idea yet. That's something to look forward to.
Yeah. We'll just have to see. But this first wave of vaccinations is going to be to prevent people from getting such a severe illness that they end up in the hospital on a ventilator or dying from COVID-19. And once we see the majority of people worldwide vaccinated, at least against one variant of COVID-19, then we're going to have to start seeing these regular booster shots that we do with the flu, for example. And then, of course, we're going to have to deal with people's resistance to vaccines.
And distribution worldwide, because there's a lot of countries that have not had access to the vaccine yet, particularly poorer countries. The WHO has a program where it's trying to get vaccines into poorer countries and get it distributed effectively there. But it's been very slow going so far.
Yeah, and that's because the two major vaccines that are available require this extreme cold storage, which, you know, you don't have in a lot of rural areas and in any country. And have at all in a lot of countries.
We're seeing the use of AstraZeneca in a lot of parts of the world, even though it seems to be less effective against the variants, specifically because it doesn't require that kind of cold storage, and it only requires one shot. And I believe the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the Novavax vaccines are the same. So that will help.
So here in the United States, there's been a lot of complaints about vaccine distribution. The Trump administration put in place a simple algorithm to allocate vaccine doses to each state according to their adult population based on census data.
And whether they voted Republican.
Yeah, but then Trump left it up to each state to figure out on its own how to allocate those shots and distribute them, and didn't provide any additional funding for setting up vaccine clinics or any additional guidance for how to go about and who to distribute the vaccine to. There's no comprehensive database to show how the vaccines are being administered, where and to whom. There's no tracking of whether vaccines are being wasted, spoiled, or thrown away. And there are lots of reports around the nation of hospitals and pharmacies having to throw away doses because they can't get enough eligible people in the door at the right time to get their shots before the vaccines spoil.
The Biden administration is having to invent all of that from scratch. And it takes a little while, you know, so they're making a lot of progress, but they've got a huge mess to clean up that was left to them.
By the Trumpistas. Yeah. In many states, online reservation sites are crashing or they're not comprehensive. You have to visit many sites or call several phone numbers to find a vaccination site with an open appointment. And this raises the bar for elderly people who don't have online access, and for disabled people who don't have the energy maybe to do this exhausting search. And it also raises the bar for essential workers who can't leave their jobs during the workday to get vaccinated. So it really points up the fact that a nationwide comprehensive program that has procedures in place for how to handle the vaccine, where people can call or go online to get an appointment, and that can set up mobile vaccine clinics to vaccinate people at their homes and at their work sites, would have been the best move. But of course, you know, that would be socialized medicine, right?
That would require that Donald
Trump
care.
We can't have that.
That would require that Donald Trump care about, you know, mass death.
Yeah, true.
And he didn't.
Yeah. So instead,
we're going to pass 500,000 deaths in the coming week.
Yes.
I don't know why he's not being impeached for that or criminally charged for that. It seems to me that, his negligence on that front is far more serious than, the Capitol insurrection was, even though that was really bad too. But we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to that now.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that now.
The House managers presented what I thought was a pretty effective, prosecution of Trump this week, not that it will necessarily make a difference. And Trump's lawyers, of course, have been widely panned for, not only being, ridiculous, but being, you know, grossly dishonest in their rebuttal. But, this morning, the Senate did vote to allow witnesses in the impeachment trial. And then they broke for a couple of hours and came back, and the prosecution and the defense came to an agreement not to call any witnesses, which I don't understand other than that senators want to get out of town. The one witness whose statement will be read into the congressional record is Washington's Jaime Herrera Butler, the representative in the House from the Southwest Washington District. She had a conversation with Kevin McCarthy, the House now minority leader, at the time majority leader, in which McCarthy said that he had a conversation with Trump in which he was yelling at Trump to, you know, on January 6th to issue a statement to stop the rioters, and Trump didn't care. Trump was delighted with the proceedings. The problem with relying on Herbert Butler rather than, say, calling McCarthy himself as a witness or calling Donald Trump himself as a witness is that it becomes hearsay. It becomes, you know, third hand, basically. So I don't think it's likely to change many votes in the Senate. The Republicans are likely to vote for acquittal overall. The vote for allowing witnesses this morning was also 55-45, same for the vote on the constitutionality. So that seems pretty baked in at this point, that 45 U.S. senators are going to stick with Trump, even though the charge of incitement to riot is pretty obvious on the face of it. I mean, it's something that, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans watched in real time on January 6th. And it would seem like that there are a lot of people who could be called as witnesses who would add clarity to what Trump was and was not doing and what his expectations were or were not around the January 6th Capitol insurrection. But, he'll get off again and he'll be allowed to run again. And he's going to continue to be a political problem in this country for some time to come, I think.
I think that kind of relies on social media bans, you know, because his major way of organizing has always been Twitter, right?
Yeah, he certainly has, is reaching his base through, sort of substitute right wing social media platforms.
Mm-hmm. But which does kind of isolate him in a way.
It does because it's not reaching the larger, American public. And you've seen,
and not allowing him to recruit for those right-wing media sources the way he was able to do in the past.
Yeah, and his message also is not being covered by sort of mainstream corporate media at this point. He's been disgraced in those platforms, so mm-hmm. they're not taking him seriously. Which obviously he has tens of millions of Americans who are still loyal to him. But we'll see what that means in terms of either low-grade violent insurgency that he's promoting or in terms of his hopes for a political future. He is definitely isolated, and he's also going to have to contend with a number of state and local level prosecutions. You know, notwithstanding anything that Merrick Garland or whoever the new attorney general turns out to be, what they decide to do with the Department of Justice. We saw, for instance, the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney this week saying she was investigating whether Trump should be charged for that phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State, in which he told us, basically threatened the Secretary of State, you know, to go out and find the votes that would flip the result in Georgia. That's potentially a violation of state law in Georgia. Reportedly now Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is under investigation for the similar phone call that he made to election officials in Georgia. You know, we have this attorney general in New York State, as well as the district attorney in Manhattan, investigating Trump on various fronts around tax fraud for the Trump Organization. So he's got a number of legal exposures that he's going to have to contend with in the next year or two. And he's always been able to evade those in the past, and we'll see if he can now.
Yeah, but still relying on social media, large social media corporations, to be the shield for this country against this. And
I totally agree.
That our elected representatives and system actually appear fine overall with the way things are going.
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying that we're relying on them to be the firewall. And that we have been unable to use the judicial system in this country to be the firewall. It has to be the private corporations, which is you know, not something that's healthy for a democracy at all.
Well, now that Trump is out of office, you know, I mean, I think the legal system has a little more efficacy, because as president, he was just subject to Congress. He's going to be subject to all these lawsuits. And that doesn't
That's not entirely true. The Justice Department had the ability to repeal their ruling that the presidency is exempt from any kind of charges. And of course, under Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr,
they had
people that were loyal enough to not only shield him from prosecution, but also shield him from an investigation.
Yeah. And now that he's out of office, that's not going to be the case. So there's not just this investigation in Georgia. There's also investigations in Manhattan. There's he's being investigated for tax fraud. You know, I mean, there's a number of lawsuits that he's being subject to. So I think now that he's no longer president, we may see him, he's also going to be fighting, debt issues as well, and he could be charged with financial fraud. So we'll see. I mean,
Trump's
going to be pretty busy.
He's in a lot of debt. He's going to have to answer to the Russian mob for that, I suspect. So we'll see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which doesn't bode well for him, but again, system-wise, whoever replaces him as the next future candidate for the extreme right won't be burdened by those problems.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the concern with Trump always has been it sets a precedent in the future for a smarter, more appealing, personally appealing version of Trump. We're still very vulnerable to that. And we have seen that one of the two major political parties in this country is just fine with an authoritarian system that ditches American democracy. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it for this week.
Okay. Well, it's been another feel-good edition. Go build a snowman.
It has. And, Maria, one more time, the Washington Legislative.
LEG.WA.GOV.